Last time Maharaj discussed about the two stages, about Nishtha and about Ruchi. Maharaj explained that Vishwacharya Thakur says something like 50% Maya and 50% Bhakti is called as Nishtha. He also explained two types of Nishtha. One was steadiness in the process and second was steadiness in the qualities. Maharaj differentiated between the Vaishnava qualities and the Sadhumada qualities, and especially Maharaj made a point that actually there is laxity of efforts. If we are not properly putting efforts, then it's unsteady. Whereas when the intense bhakti happens, that time the steady devotional service can manifest. Later Maharaj also described the importance of humility. He said that humility is necessary to actually progress. Not just to progress, but to actually begin and then to advance. That's how we will actually come to the Nishtha stage. By steadily progressing, seeing our own defects, recognizing our own inabilities. Later Maharaj described about Ruchi also. Maharaj, if you could please begin from Ruchi. Because it was like last time we could not complete it, and if you please start from the original stage. Actually, to understand this stages is very, very difficult. It's only when some great Vaishnava explains, we can actually put, if we put attention, we inquire submissively and take it to our heart, we can actually try to begin to understand these stages and hopefully one day actually come to this fine mercy of Vaishnavas. Thank you.
After Nishtha, we get an increase of attraction for Krishna and a decrease in the influence of Maya. So there's slightly more influence of bhakti and less influence of the anarjas. And so the process of anarja nivritti is still going on. And it will continue into ashakti and into bhava stage. But here, the bhakti is more prominent than the influence of anarjas. So therefore, we'll see that the activities of bhakti become more spontaneous, one has more attraction for the activities like hearing and chanting, etc. We have less influence of, or less inspiration simply from people ordering us to do this or by rule and regulation. So we have a positive taste because of increase of bhakti. Which means that the more anartas are there, the less taste one has. So, of course, there's actually a taste all the way through bhakti, otherwise we don't perform it at all. If there's no taste at all, we won't do it. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur also explains that with Shraddha itself, there's a slight taste already. We have a preference or some attraction for the Supreme Lord. So this increases and increases a little. When it becomes quite prominent that this is a major influence, then it becomes the Ruchi stage. Anartas are still there, but nevertheless, the bhakti can become more steady and we can say more spontaneous because of the increase in that bhakti. So this is a transformation of the jiva. It's not simply the mind. Of course, the mind is a reflection of the what's taking place within the jiva. So the jiva has more and more attraction for the Lord. And consequently, it's reflected in the mind and the senses, etc. Okay, so by steady practice, then, when we're at Nishtha and we keep doing the different activities of bhakti, engaging our senses and mind, then that bhakti becomes stronger, stronger, stronger. So, it operates, let's say, it becomes a major influence. That's what it means when it says it's propelled by its own energy. So the bhakti becomes quite prominent to inspire the devotee to do everything. And we don't have to rely on intelligence or mind, etc., or rules and regulations so much. Consequently, one enthusiastically performs the process of bhakti, like hearing and chanting, and one doesn't feel tired when doing it. And we found that in before Nishtha, there was a tendency for sleep and some lack of taste and so many things like that. But at this stage, even if one is physically tired or whatever, one actually is very alert to bhakti because of that attraction for it. And one becomes more and more attracted to the activities of bhakti in the ruchi stage. So this is a very positive stage of development. And the example is given of a young Brahmana boy who studies the scripture. So in the beginning, he doesn't know much, and he has to struggle. He has to practice and keep doing it. And then eventually he understands the meaning, and he can understand the rules of grammar, etc. He has no difficulty in reading and studying, etc. And then he starts developing a taste for that pleasure. He gets pleasure out of his studies and reading, etc. So, Vishnu Chakrabarti Thakur also gives the example of, because this is ruchi means taste. So in the beginning, we don't have taste for Krishna. We have a strong taste for Maya. Because of this defect of the jiva, that we have a tendency to be attracted to Maya, that is what looks like, that is what we perceive as very sweet. And on the other hand, Krishna, not sweet. Just like if one has jaundice, a liver defect, then sugar doesn't taste sweet. A different perception, even though for other people, normal people, it is sweet. For the person who has the sickness, it doesn't taste sweet. So for people who are advanced devotees, yes, chanting is sweet. Studying about Krishna, hearing about Krishna is very sweet. But for one who has got a very strong tendencies for Maya, then doesn't have that taste. He doesn't perceive it as attractive. However, the cure for this lack of taste is to continue the process of bhakti in spite of not having the taste, just as the cure for jaundice is to take the sugar in spite of the fact that you don't like it because it doesn't taste very good. It tastes bitter. But still, we take the medicine. So the medicine is the process of bhakti, which doesn't have so much attraction in it in the beginning. But as we do it, then gradually we get cured of the sickness and we begin to perceive it is actually sweet. So we can say the stage of ruchi is when we get that perception that it actually is very wonderful, Krishna is very attractive, and the processes of bhakti, they give great joy to it. But before that, we can't perceive that much. So this is a very positive stage in devotional development. So I said there is a little taste in all the way through, but it becomes more prominent here. So we're covered over by ignorance, and then it develops into all these different things like raga and devesha and abhinavesh or whatever. Thus we can't perceive the proper sweetness of the process of hearing and chanting. But by continually doing it, then we develop that taste. So two types of taste are here. That depending on excellence of the, you can say, the material elements. The singer has a nice voice. He keeps time, proper tala. He sings in tune. He knows the words properly, pronounces the words properly. So the presentation of the singing or whatever is very good. Similarly, if we have a speaker, then because he tells nice stories, very interesting, exciting stories, and they say, oh, very nice, like this. And he can explain them, and he has lots of stories to tell them. They're very, very nice. So that's going to say it's a type of ruchi, because we're attracted to it, definitely. But it depends on the material qualities. So therefore, it's going to say inferior. So the real ruchi is when we're attracted to the devotion in the devotional practices. Because the devotion of the singer, the matter of his singing is not so skillful or whatever. And because the subject matter is Krishna, we're attracted to that. So this is a sign of purity. We've reached a stage of ruchi, that stage where we are attracted to the processes themselves and the devotees who are doing them because of their purity. So when the devotee reaches ruchi stage, then he laments his previous condition. And we find many prayers of the devotees like this, or many songs where they say, I was in Maya and wasting my time in this material world, drinking poison and all this stuff. Lamentation of previous condition is there, a regret for being covered by ignorance for so long. And as opposed to that, then he's constantly hearing and chanting and performing other devotional activities. He's absorbed in these. And less attraction for doing material activities. And generally, they'll tend to take refuge of the Dhamma. So we see that the person becomes naturally renounced at this stage, not interested in maintaining his body and family and whatever duties in society, withdrawing himself and becoming more absorbed in the practice of bhakti. So this is a type of renunciation that takes place naturally. It's not an artificial imposition. Vishnu Chakravarti also compares the development of bhakti to be like a dance. And first you have to learn all the different steps of the dance, the different postures, the different mudras, and whatever. So that takes some time. And then the dance instructor, the teacher, is Ruchi. So at the Ruchi stage, then he can very skillfully dance because of the instructor, so it's Ruchi. And very, very quickly he can experience the bliss that is going to develop through asakti and bhava and prema. He starts to more and more joy out of the act. Just as a dancer who's very expert can experience this great joy when he displays his various moves and steps, etc. That was Ruchi.
I think this two types of Ruchi, one is real and one is which is dependent on the material things,
yeah.
So it's not real.
Yeah.
So just like in the kirtans, person will be attracted to the tune and the music. Similarly, in the lectures or in the shastra also, one will be attracted only to the logic and to the coherence, etc. Logic, etc. Not the dry logic, not to the devotion, actually.
Yeah.
So how to see that we are not only attracted to simply logical, intellectual stuff or things in the shastra, but actually attracted to Krishna and the devotion?
Well, ultimately, that attraction or ruchi will give us spiritual joy. Now, if we're attracted to the material elements, we can be some sort of joy or happiness, but we can say that's more on the material level. So we have two types of happiness, material happiness and spiritual happiness. Just as in the material world, people become blissful from hearing different types of music or whatever like that, which are all material. So we can get attraction that way. Now, we can actually combine the two in order to attract materialists. So by doing things very skillfully and musically, etc., you can attract material people. Oh, that's nice music. But then, of course, they get tricked into the devotion also through that process. So we don't have to necessarily, sing badly. We can, have a strategy presenting these very attractively so that materialists can at least get attracted to the musical aspect or the material aspect. And through that, then they can also develop spiritually, whatever. But one who's truly on Ruchi, then, even if it's not skillfully done or whatever, if the person has devotion, then he's very attracted to that because he can detect the devotion, whatever. Even in Nishta, we see that the person who's on Nishta can detect the level of the person, if he's a nishta or not a nishta, and he has some ability to appreciate the devotional aspect of a person.
Right, so if you give some examples, like then we may be able to understand. Like sometimes, because when we coming from academic background, say from intellectual background of IIT, etc., sometimes a person may want to study the scripture 8 hours also. But then one may not be actually, you may be simply getting some rasa which is material, mundane rasa, but not actually spiritual rasa. So how do we exactly differentiate that it is not mundane, it is actually spiritual?
Well, as far as study is concerned and logic, our acharyas say that there's nothing wrong with logic as long as it follows after scripture. So the logic which is condemned is when we go independent of the conclusions of scripture and whatever, and we start speculating on our own about the meaning of things. So if it's in line with the scripture, fine. Now, we do have many works which are all rasa, etc., in our Goswami. But then we have some which are more based on logic. So for instance, we have the Sandarbhas, which are basically this all about Krishna, etc., but it's a logical presentation to convince people that there is a scriptural proof for whatever is said, and that it makes sense. And then we have things like Brahma Sutras, which is a logical presentation of the Upanishads in a presentation. And then we have the commentaries on Vedanta Sutra, which are also very logical. And that's to use logic, lots of logical principles to come to a proper conclusion about what the scripture says. So nothing wrong with that. And some persons may be attached to that part of the scripture. So we see even our acharyas have a tendency to be like that. Vishwajarvati's into the rasa part, Baladeva Vidyabhusan's into the logical, philosophical part. And we see many acharyas like Madhva and Ramanuja were also highly attracted to the logical part, not that they didn't have any, rasa, but they were attracted to that, or they became prominent. And one of the features is because they did have to logically defeat impersonalism, which was Shankar, who had to use a lot of logic also. And he had to use a lot of logic because he was fighting the Buddhas, who also had a lot of logic, using logic. So, in other words, because in the material world, logic is quite popular, then we also have to use logic to defend ourselves against them, whatever. So some devotees may be interested in that aspect. There's nothing wrong with it, because the subject is still Krishna. We see that the Uttamadhikari in Vaidhi Bhakti is the one who has deep knowledge of scripture and logically can present it and understands it nicely, the conclusion, through logical processes. So he's called the Uttamadhikari in Vaidhi Bhakti. So therefore, that's a good stage, because he can present things nicely to people and defeat their false arguments, etc. So to that extent, it's okay. But if it's an escape from other aspects of sadhana, that's also not healthy. So one studies, but one doesn't chant or attend regular programs or associate with devotees, and that's an unhealthy sign, because it's not a balanced process of spiritual development. So we should not be one-sided also in our approach.
Guru Maharaj, it means that somebody getting an increase in the ruchi, as he develops the taste for chanting and hearing, does it mean that he will neglect the other angas of bhakti and other services? Only concentrate on hearing and chanting.
You could be deep doing deity worship or anything. It could be ruchi reflected in any process of bhakti. But those things which are material, that is maintaining his body, maintaining his family and all this, is start developing disinterest in those things. And that's why it says he goes to Dham and lives in Vrindavan or something, which means he's renounced, more or less renounced himself. So he may not do that in ruchi, but at least a tendency is to become disinterested in material affairs at that point.
Maharaj, also, is the presence of humility and service to Vaishnavas is also an important sign of the ruchi? Because you find Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is the highest scholar as Nimai Pandit, but even he is serving the Vaishnavas in a very humble way. Uh-huh. And also, Dashrathi, from Ramanujacharya, we know that Dashrathi was sent to serve the lady relative of Ramanuja. Mm-hmm. And then he served over there in a very humble way. So then Ramanujacharya said that actually you are not just a scholar but a devotee, because you submitted to the will of the spiritual master.
Well, yes, humility is intrinsic also to the beginning of bhakti itself, and it's surrender itself has to have an element of humility. And Sanatan Goswami says that those in prema have the highest humility. And among those, the gopis got the highest humility of all. So they feel the most unworthy of serving Krishna. So the higher you go, the more that humility becomes prominent. Another thing about study, and we see that in the Angas of Bhakti, among the second 10, when there is... Don't study. But it's don't study asat shastra, the wrong things with not devotion. On the other hand, it is okay to study those things which are devotional literature. But then again, there's a thing that if you do that, then the motive is not to make a profession of it. We study all these things so we can speak nicely and get money to support our family, which is what that's why Prabhupada condemns the Bhagavad Sampada speakers, because generally in India they are grihasthas and they go out and they speak for Bhagavatam and then people give them a lot of money. So then he condemns that as being a professional, using your study and knowledge for professional things. And they may not even be Vaishnavas like that. They're just doing it as a profession. And they may ultimately think that Krishna is illusory and he's got a material body, and then they do a whole Bhagavad Katha like this and they get donations. So that's useless also. Another is to simply study in order to defeat other people. So that's again a material motive. So if our process of study of the scriptures, even devotional scriptures, is there, but it has a material motive, then that's also not good. But on the other hand, we have the Uttamadhikari and Vaidhi Bhakti, then he has lots of knowledge of scripture and whatever. And this means his faith is stronger. This is a category of faith within Vaidhi Bhakti, because he has the knowledge of scripture with logical backup and steadiness. He's got great faith, or highest faith within Vaidhi Bhakti.
Jnana being a character of the Atma itself, Jnana, knowledge, being a characteristic of the Atma itself, does the knowledge are manifested, or it is, how is the process? If something goes in and absorbed, or it is naturally there, which is manifested when we read something?
Well, when you say knowledge, or the, to perceive objects, is a nature. Perception, experience, and activity are part of the nature of the jiva. So he's a karta, a doer, he's a gyata, a knower, and he's a bhokta, an experiencer. So these are intrinsic to the jiva. And even if he's in the material world, these things manifest, but in a rather distorted way. So as a gyata, then he's covered with ahankara and ignorance, and then he perceives things in this world, but he doesn't perceive them properly. So his knowledge is contaminated. He sees objects in terms of his enjoyment, but he's still a perceiver. He still has knowledge, but it is, wrong knowledge. And he experiences, but his experiences are also related to his material body. So his concept of happiness that he experiences is because of the material body. And he does things, but he's doing these things with the material body for his own pleasure. Now we take the take away the material body and the hankara, then what does the jiva do? And so in one sense, nothing. So that's the Brahman state. He is a perceiver and doer, but he hasn't developed any object of perception nor instruments for doing activity spiritually. He had a material body with the senses, etc. But take all those things away, then he's just a jiva. So, when you do bhakti, by engaging what we call our material senses and our material mind and intelligence, etc., we develop spiritual senses, spiritual mind. So when the material body with its subtle body with all the senses in the mind are destroyed,
then we're left with spiritual body, spiritual senses, and we perceive the Lord. So therefore, the nature of the jiva is manifested in a state where he can be a doer, because he has arms and legs or whatever. He's a knower, because he has senses like the eyes and the ears and the voice, etc. And he can experience because of his, like you say, his spiritual mind and bhadini shakti, etc.
Since we now also understand that in more than Nishtha Ruchi, the presence of humility is essential thing. So, could you explain, Maharaj, how does one develop this genuine humility? Because one can become not proud of anything, even once, although the Uttam Adhikari may be having so much knowledge and Shastra, Yukti, etc., but he is very humble. Because,
yeah.
As you said, gopis are the highest humility.
Yeah.
So how do they actually develop this genuine humility?
Well, that's part of the process of, inherent in the process of bhakti, if it's cultivated properly. If it's not cultivated properly, then the humility will not manifest, which means something is wrong with the whole process. So that's why Jiva Goswami says the first process is surrender, saranagati. And that includes that adanya, or misery, or whatever, kapanya, feeling of other worthlessness, etc., and lowness. And of course, in Shraddha itself, you can see there is the feeling of lowness, because we have to recognize the position of the Lord. You know, we even know there's the Supreme Lord at the top, then there's Devatas, and there's regular Jivas, and we're kind of at the bottom. So if we don't recognize that in the very beginning of bhakti, in our Shraddha, then throughout the whole process, humility will not develop. So proper Shraddha is in the beginning, and then there's the Sharanagati, etc., and as we begin the process of hearing and chanting. If that doesn't go, if it's not there, then the process of bhakti doesn't work properly. So it cannot be intellectual also. If you simply study, read it in a book, okay, draw a little diagram of this, here's Krishna, here's Sasiva, okay, fine. But we don't really believe it, in one sense. So in other words, it has to be a conviction in the jiva. It's not a mental conviction. So that's why to develop real faith takes a long time, many, many births. Because the jiva has to change his whole conception of things and his tendency. So when that becomes, the jiva has enough, which is not so much, but Shraddha manifests, it's not the highest Shraddha, it's a little bit of tendency, it becomes conscious to accept the Lord and his position, etc., and inherit, and that we can say there is humility itself also. And then in the process of surrendering, that the humility is necessary. And that is why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Shastika also says that, you know, you have to be humble in the blade of grass and not expect honor from others, etc. If you want to chant constantly, sada, all the time, then you have to have that humility. Okay. So it's intrinsic to the whole process of bhakti.
Is there any way we can, what we can do so that we can be having Sharanagati a little faster also? Because it will take us so many lifetimes if we are not cautious now.
Well, Sharanagati also is an anga of bhakti, just as hearing and chanting, etc. So we can practice it as an anga. And there's, of course, the six elements there, yeah? Accepting what is favorable, rejecting what is unfavorable, thinking of us as dependent on the Supreme Lord, and he's the master, etc., and that one is very miserable and can offer everything, body, mind, and words to the Lord. Like you want to cultivate that. So that's more, it's not a physical thing, it's a mental state. But nevertheless, it's an anga of bhakti. Like Atmanivedana also is an anga of bhakti, which is largely mental as well. But they're considered processes of bhakti in themselves.
Maharaj, also, for the sake of benefit of the devotees, if you please explain that, because now we see you as our, like, Siksha Guru, and we wish to follow your footsteps. If you also know, like, how when you were brought by Prabhupada to India, and in the very beginning of, you had to do so many various services, though your nature would be something to study the Shastra, but Prabhupada also engaged you in various services at the moment. Even now we see that you are very actively engaged in the management, etc. So if you please also explain us that, how does that, for us, how can we struggle that we just don't get carried away by our Swabhava in Bhakti, But like we just try to dovetail, so how about the other, we surrender this Sharanagati process with integrity. If you can please, from your example.
What we can say in terms of surrender itself, that we depend on the Lord. There's a dependency on the Lord there. That we regard Him as the controller and the master. And so in all circumstances, we simply take whatever service He gives. So that's there as an element. We may have certain preferences, and consequently, when we do certain things, we may not be very good at it or whatever. Nevertheless, if there's if it's necessary to do, we do all those different things on behalf of the Lord. Now, in a society, it's a little different. If we're independent, then we don't have such necessity. But within a society, then there's so many exterior, what's it, external needs or of the society that are there that are put on us also. And we have to do them. So, whereas if you're individual, those things wouldn't be there. It would be more just personal circumstances. So it's a little more complicated when we have a society, etc., with its own goals, etc. So, but we do have to sacrifice to some degree and do what is necessary in cooperation with other persons. So we may have to take responsibilities that are there because there's no one else to do with them. So the devotee takes all these things as some sort of service to the Lord. They're all services, and they can all help us advance if we have the proper attitude in doing them.
And also, renunciation from the material things was also one of the characteristics of Ruchi. So now if I have to think about Vaishnava who is in Grihastha Ashram, then if this Ruchi state comes right in the beginning, then how will he be able to maintain his family life?
It would be very difficult, because he wouldn't be interested in it. But it's highly unlikely. He just probably wouldn't become a grihastha in the beginning if he would have the ruchi. He would be very disinterested in the whole material life. So if they are married already, then it looks like they're not at the ruchi stage. Maybe they can come up to nishtha or whatever they might, but they wouldn't be at the stage. But generally, they become naturally detached from everything. So the other point, of course, is that it may take them time to get to Ruchi. So by the time they get to Ruchi, they'd also be advanced in age. So they would have no more family anyway, technically. So then they could take Vanaprastha or Sannyas or whatever, Babaji or whatever.
But still, as you said, Mumbai, the society may, the circumstances may force somebody to take up to the grass or some, even if they're being in the circumstances and the society, needs of the society.
Yeah, that's also there's some circumstances that may be like that. So then they have to tolerate the situation. The problem with the detachment and everything is that it cannot really be successful unless all the responsibilities are completed. So if you still have dependents and you're not taking care of them, but that's your responsibility, you cannot really be detached because you're gonna have problems there later on. You're gonna be, they're gonna disturb you. The other people are gonna disturb you, and people criticize and whatever. So one has to actually fulfill one's responsibilities. So as the attraction becomes greater, then it is called attachment or asakti. Sakti. So the plant was a seed that was placed in the fertile heart, which was Shraddha, the fertile field of the heart, which is the jiva. So when the jiva has enough faith, then the seed will start growing. So the seed of bhakti is there. And begins to. We get two leaves, first of all, that is, Pleshik leads to Bada, and starts developing more and more. And then it develops buds before the flower. So Asakti is like the buds. And what happens to the bud? It turns into a flower. So what is the flower? Bhava. Bhava is the flower, Asakti is the bud. So therefore, this is something like Baba. It's getting very close to Baba, so there's similarity there. There's also difference. Similarity is also there, so that's why it's called the Bhad. It's the next stage. So in Ruchi, the process, hearing and chanting, was the that's what we relish. But in Asakti, it's not the process, it's Krishna who's in that process. That you chant in your attraction to Krishna in the name. Not just the process of chanting, but Krishna. So it's becoming, Krishna's becoming more tangible as an object of realization. So it's more and more attractive here. It's not that there's no attraction to Krishna in earlier stages, but it becomes more prominent, and the process in itself becomes less prominent. So Krishna becomes more and more prominent because of one is approaching the realization in bhava stage. So in Ruchi it was spontaneous, but still one half takes some effort to withdraw the mind from material things and concentrate on the Lord. In Asakti is spontaneous, very spontaneous. So you can say spontaneity is more in Asakti stage. So, of course, from the beginning stages, Narjana Vritti and Nishta and Ruchi and Asakti, we're trying to concentrate on the process and concentrate on Krishna. But in the beginning stages, Anishta Bhakti, then it's very difficult. We have all these distractions. In Nishta stage, we can control the distractions and we can perform our practice steadily. And in Ruchi stage, it becomes easier. We have a taste. So it's easier to control the distractions. And then in Asakti stage, then spontaneously we're attracted to for Krishna and the process itself. And mainly because the Krishna is becoming more and more prominent as an object of attraction. And then the Lord may appear. So this is, gives a resemblance to bhava stage. But it's not an actual appearance. It's like a reflection of Krishna that flashes in the heart momentarily. So it's almost at the stage of bhava because there's a little perception of Krishna. So therefore, that's why the Krishna becomes more prominent in the process. Right? So it's not the actual appearance, but it's some reflection of it, something, a trace of it.
With all this sort of knowledge, usually, one of them says the devotees try to judge their level where they are, and sometimes they get carried away by what they're relating themselves with this knowledge. This is not actually, I don't think that should be the process. Naturally, we should keep doing our services. How to avoid this sort of judgment or judging our status in progress?
Well, actually, these processes are there so that we can locate ourselves within these different processes, whether Narjana Rifti or Nishta Ruchi Asakti, etc. However, if we actually look at this in detail, then we'll see that most people are somewhere between Narjana Rifti and somewhere in Nishta. So not many people are having flashes of Krishna in their so they're not Asakti. Some may be a little more spontaneous, so we can say maybe they have Ruchi. So that's maybe the extent of most of the devotees. So if they think they're above our prema, then that's more or less illusory. But then there'll be certain symptoms of that also, and then by that we can understand the person's only imagining. But here we see there's a natural, with Ruchi itself, there's a natural detachment from material things and an absorption in spiritual processes. So that can be externally observed by other people also, whether they actually are detached from material things and absorbed in processes of Krishna. Then he is more advanced. And if he's more has more attachment to material things, then less advanced. This is a very obvious way we can see the level of people. So in Ruchi, Asakti, Bhava, and Prema, then we don't really notice their attraction for material things at all. It's become quite minor. It'd be obvious that they're not at that stage if they do have material attachments.
Well, there is sometimes just like momentary appearance of Krishna is there for the Asakti stage devotee. Sometimes there could be detachment due to frustrations. in the life actually.
Oh yeah, sir. So, definitely.
So how do we say that? Because it may appear, it will go on for a few months also actually for a person, that he is so frustrated from material life that he just doesn't want to take material responsibility, then he may start thinking that actually I have become very advanced.
So actually, detachment itself is not a sign of advancement spiritually. It's one sign, the other is attachment to Krishna. So the two have to be there. If you're only detached from material things, you can become an impersonalist or Mayavadi or whatever, the Jain or whatever, Buddhist or anything. So detachment in itself may have many causes. Like the Avanti Brahmana, you become detached from everything because he's frustrated with family life. But then again, he did have faith in the Supreme Lord, so two things were there. But his material circumstances also pushed him into detachment, but he also had faith in the Supreme Lord, so that was a good thing. So we can't judge simply on detachment. We have the other side, we have to see how much he's absorbed in spiritual things. If he is spontaneously absorbed, fine, and then he's very advanced. So we call this type of detachment Sahaj Vairagya. It's not that he's attained it by practice detachment. This is a natural result of his attachment to the Lord. So that we can't separate the two things. If we just see the attachment and know what your attraction for Krishna, then that's not real advancement in bhakti.
Continuing the same thing, because it becomes very difficult even in the grihastha life. Sometimes the two devotees are there. It depends on the advancement level of each other. Sometimes they are not very careful while they are marrying. So now, or they will be pushed by family members. So if the advancement of two people is different, very different. Now somebody may be going very close.
Husband and wife. Okay.
So now husband or someone may be very advanced and may be actually going from nishtha towards ruchi. Whereas the other partner may be at a lower stage. So then while someone may not even want to have a child, but the other partner's necessity is that there should be a child, etc. So in such situations, like, what would be the right balance? Because he doesn't want to entangle himself also, but at the same time, he should not come out of responsibilities artificially.
Yeah, well, if they are married, then they have to carry out the responsibilities of married life, that's all. they cannot neglect that as a married person. So that means they do have to, you know, to some degree, have those material attachments or whatever. Or not have them, but at least cater to the other person in the marriage.
Also, Maharaj, is one of the 20 out of the next 10 limbs of devotional service, it is that one should not advaita na kolibe. He says that one should not be causing hurt or harm to the other living entity. So is it not that we are also sensitive while being detached, as you were mentioning, that while detachment is being brought naturally by bhakti, but is it not that we are also sensitive to the needs of others around us? We may, for example, Sanatana Goswami was living in the caves, etc. But then, when I think Jagdanath Pandit went to Vrindavan, so at that time he was cooking for him various types of bhoga prasadam. Whereas he was in a sort of detached. But then for Jagdananda, he was preparing very nice meals, etc. So, like, one may be personally getting detached, but is it not one is simultaneously taking care of the needs of others who may be lesser advanced or of lesser taste,
etc.? That's also there. Of course, for impersonalism, generally, as we see in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 2, whatever, the Siddha Pragya, then he's just completely like that. So he's not really kind of indifferent to everything. But then the commentary is that there should be some compassion even in that type of even in the impersonalist detachment of the Siddha Pragya. You should have some sort of compassion for other living entities, that's some small trace of it. As far as the Vaishnava is concerned, there's also there, but it's a little bit different because it's in terms of devotion, so the compassion is in terms of helping people become devotees. And stuff. So that is never lost. So it won't be compared to detached from the material world, but we're not detached from teaching, instructing, and encouraging others to perform bhakti in advance and devotional service. We can't give up that attachment. That's not something you give up with detachment. Otherwise, it becomes more like the impersonals.
Also, Mahaprabhu is known as Matra Bhakta Shiromani. So, of course, in her case, his mother is Sachi Mata, and Sachi Mata is Yashoda Maiya only. But does it also mean that in our life, our relatives who have given so much service to us before we in this life came to Krishna consciousness, should we also not be concerned about them and help them in their path towards devotional service?
No. Well, in one sense, one delivers all one's relatives by becoming a devotee, so you don't have to worry about them in one sense. But also, we should not be indifferent to their spiritual progress, etc., because they're also persons, whatever, devotees, they can be devotees, whatever. So we try to help them to an extent that they are can be favorable or whatever, like that. At the same time, as one advances, then one doesn't have such an attachment to relatives and parents, etc. One will look at everybody rather than simply, these are my people or whatever, because one becomes more detached from family relationship, etc. So it's not going to be exclusively a concern for family members, but it's for people in general, he would have that same type of compassion. So be less focused as he advances and advances. And one reason is that ultimately that type of attachment is a material bondage. So if we still have that attachment as we progress, then that actually pulls us back again. Because in prema, we see everything in relation to Krishna, not in relation to my mother, father, etc.
Also, we see Narad Muni is showing compassion on the relatives of the devotees. He comes to Dhruva Maharaj because Samo Manu is his name. Samo is a pure devotee. So he comes to Dhruva. And Dhruva is not looking for Krishna at that time, but still he is coming and interfering in his path. So does it show to us something like the relatives of the devotees are more dear than the general people?
Well, a person exalted devotees are free to show their mercy to everybody. But obviously, though the devotee doesn't preach to the faithless persons, and then he favors the persons who have faith and those who are advanced, and accordingly he may give his mercy in different degrees to these different types of people. And then, on the other hand, it may be extraordinarily merciful, as in the case of Murgari the Hunter, who was completely unqualified, we could say, in the beginning, because he was, you know, killing animals and watching them die, etc. But it was very merciful. So that's the privilege of the devotee himself to choose who to give mercy to. He may be completely unqualified, or he may have a slight qualification, or be highly qualified also. And he may give different types of mercy to these persons. And sometimes it's inexplainable. So, regarding the unqualified, then he got Baba in 3 months. So, they give great mercy to him. And of course, to Dhruva, then in 6 months, then he saw the Lord also. You know, he's 5 years old, whatever like that. Great devotees can do extraordinary things. And their mercy may be unexplainable from our point of view.
Is this a valid understanding that the just like for Krishna, his own devotees are very dear. Similarly, devotees' relatives are also very dear to him. That's why he gives a benediction to Prahlad Maharaj. That your father will also, and father, he also asks for his father, who is a demon, that actually can you please deliver him? So does it show to us that we learn a lesson? Those are relatives of the Vaishnavas. They are the special, they have some special place in the heart of Krishna. So the Vaishnavas also should show a little more compassion.
That's true in the sense that just like in the material world, one has to, in the Nitya Karmas, then one has debtors, Rinna. And then one was your ancestors and your, and then you have to tarpanas for them because they produced you ultimately. Genetically, good sense. You're a product of that lineage that goes back so long. So therefore, you have to acknowledge that and be grateful to that, show gratitude to those ancestors or whatever. That's the material gratitude, of course. Spiritually also, we can say that that's recognized, and therefore the Lord also gives mercy to the relatives, etc., because they're also responsible. So they must have some agatasutra, in other words. We can say it's their agatasutra, that the present persons of devotees, so therefore they're related, so therefore they get some mercy from the Lord as well. Okay, so in attachment, asakti, the person becomes very attractive to devotees and hearing from them, so Shravana becomes quite prominent here, and he sees everything in relationship with Krishna.
We see, of course, that that's also a sign of an uttama vikara. They see everything in terms of Supreme Lord. And he's constantly thinking of how to attain Krishna. So obviously he's not involved in material activities at all. He's just thinking of how to get Krishna. And he disregards the opinions of others at this stage. So there in Madhurika Namani, Krishna Chakrabarti, he describes this person, and other people begin to criticize him. He's not doing his duties to society or your family members or whatever. Yeah, he acts, maybe he's crazy, he doesn't act normally. So that they will criticize him in various ways. But he disregards all of that. He's not interested in that at all. Completely detached from criticism on the stage. One asks, what is the matter of my friend? He remains silent and sometimes hides his feelings. His friends will apologize. It was all right before, but now his intelligence became covered. The followers of the Dhanu will conclude he's an idiot by birth, because he's not following a regular process of doing jnana, or, he's looks like a madman instead, and he's simply chanting and absorbing himself in Krishna. So you'll get criticism from all sorts of people. Followers of Vedic ritual consider him fallen from purity because he's not interested in doing his nitya karmas or non-nitya karmas, etc. Non-devotees will say he's amassed some great treasure, and therefore he's hiding it from, he's hoarding his money or something. And offenders will say he's pretending. So, because he's in a very detached state, people will find some excuse to criticize him. Various people will have various excuses to criticize him at this stage. So, the devotee, on the other hand, is completely aloof from getting respect or disrespect. And he's, this now compares the devotee to the whole process. It's like a river, and he's fallen into the river of attachment to Krishna. And it's just simply carried by that river. And he's only trying to attain Krishna. So, completely attached to everything material.
Any questions, my Vaishnavas?
Thank you, Raj Maharaj, for such a wonderful lecture. Dasapti stage, you mentioned that up to Ruchi, Bhajan is the object of taste, and Dasapti Krishna is the object of taste. But we also say that devotional service is a process where means and end are the same. So, is it that bhajan or devotional service or practices of devotional service are separate energy of Lord here, or
practice and? Oh, the practice is the sadhana is also the sadhya. So, hearing and chanting are a sadhana in order to obtain bhava and prema. But then they become bhava and prema also. Because in bhava and prema, one continues hearing and chanting. A material sadhana is finished when you get the goal. So when you study, you get your degree, then you stop studying. So study was the sadhana, the goal was the degree. When you get the degree, you stop the study. So sadhana, chanting is the sadhana, and you get bhava, that's the goal. But you don't stop the chanting. So it's sadhana, and you continue after that. I mean, it becomes an anubhava. Which means one of the activities within bhava. So it's one of the symptoms are intrinsic to the state of bhava is the chanting process. So it's part of bhava itself. So then it's the sadhya, it's the goal itself. So that's it, sadhana and sadhya. Now, as far as Krishna and the process, in sadhana, yes, we're emphasizing the process of it. When we have sadhana, then the non-difference becomes there. Krishna is not different from the name. Or any process of bhakti is not different from Krishna. So that becomes, because we realize Krishna, then the two become indistinguishable.
And also the bhava state, even in the, we find even in the raganuga bhakti, when somebody is doing, and also in the bhava state, is it not that, for example, there are eight periods of the day in which Krishna's activities are going on, so then is it not that one starts also getting inside that and one is actually serving Krishna in various other ways apart from just chanting? Chanting is continuing, but internally one is also serving that.
That's in Raghunuga. So as one goes through, let's say, Nishtha, Ruchi, Asakti in Raghunuga, that's also sadhana, that's not bhava. So it has to be in a previous stage, at least Nishtha, Ruchi, Asakti, we can say. Well, it can start before then also, but in general we can say Nishtha, Ruchi, Asakti. So we're following that process. But in the beginning stage, where Narjana Vritti, it's very difficult to practice the smarana, that is, internally meditating, it'd be more difficult. As we get to Nishtha, it becomes easier, because we have a ruchi, then we're quite, and asakti, quite easy to do those things, because mind is under control, and we're more attracted to Krishna. So smarana is also a type of one of the angas of bhakti, so we're having smarana of the activities of Krishna. So. But they become easier in Ruchi and Asakti, definitely.
So, because the Raghunuga sadhana, if one is not performing, then one will not go to Vraja. This is very clearly defined.
Yeah.
So, how ISKCON devotees could be actually, of course, if the Anarthavritti is yet not it's not becoming proper, then of course one cannot practice it properly. But still, how would a ISKCON devotee be also? Because we are aspiring for Vraja Prem.
That, of course, is a, you could say, a unresolved problem of ISKCON. not only in ISKCON, in Gaudiya Math also. Some other yogis may criticize, oh, you're not going to go to Krishna Vrindavan, you'll go to Aishwarya Golok or Dwarka or somewhere else. So that's an unresolved problem. But even within ISKCON, we could say that to some extent, there is an influence of Raghunuga in the sense that we're worshipping Radha Krishna and obviously their Vrindavan forms. So we say, okay, it's like Naranaran because it's Vaidhi Bhakti or whatever. So it's kind of a mixture of Vaidhi and Raghunuga in one sense. And we have at least regular hearing of scripture in the form of Bhagavatam, which is the main scripture one should hear, even in Raghunuga. So that part is there. And then the other ones are absorption and chanting and smarana, etc. So that's the free will of the particular devotee. And as particularly as they may get older and retired, etc., then they can devote more time to that. So then they can start practicing some elements of Raghunuga. So in the Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami says, if one finds it difficult to practice Raghunuga, we'll combine it with Vaidhi also, have a mixture of Vaidhi and Raghunuga. Take some elements of Raghunuga and mix it with the Vaidhi Bhakti and do that also. So there's some, and we have some preliminary elements of Raghunuga mixed with our Vaidhi, and then from that later on we can do Raghunuga.
Because will it not be, we want to be sure that will it not be that we will be missing out the goal of Vraja Prema itself if we do not come to Raghunuga Sadhana? Is it like that?
But yeah, but that's the general principle as stated in the scriptures and Chaitanya Charitamrita, etc. Of course, there may be some exceptional cases, mercy, etc.
And also we say, Chaitanya Charitamrita says that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to give the Raghunuga Bhakti, Raghunuga Sadhana. So then how do we talk about that? Then we can mix Vaidhi and Raghunuga, but ultimately is it not that we have to do Raghunuga Sadhana?
To get to Krishna, in Vrindavan. If you want to go to Dwarka, then you can do Vaidhi Bhakti and go to Dwarka, whatever, or Mathura. Or even Aishwarya Goloka. You go to Aishwarya Goloka, which is almost like it's Krishna as a convert, but there's little reverence in that worship as well. So it has all the rasas, the same as in Gokul, but little reverence is there also. It's a mixture. So it's a little bit less intense.
Where is it situated?
Just outside, borderline of Gokul.
Anand, you said that we cannot preach to the faithless and that we should preach to the faithful. How do we identify who has faith and who doesn't have faith?
We have to use our discretion and intelligence. We need a little intelligence to, and observatory power to distinguish who has faith and who has no faith. But obviously, if a person has no interest and becomes a little disturbed when you talk about Krishna, then obviously he has no faith. So therefore, we cannot preach. All we can do is expose him to bhakti. One, of course, is the devotee himself. That's agyata sukriti for him if he associates with you.
even if he doesn't know you're a devotee. If he knows you're a devotee, then he may not associate. So, simply the association itself, this is a gyatra sukriti. And if you give him prasada, or if he just hears the name, or he sees a picture, then you don't have to talk about it. But that's a gyatra sukriti also.
In India, it is very hard to find truly faithless people. It's very hard to find truly faithless people. Those who become completely envious as soon as you start about.
You have atheists, maybe, or something like that, or maybe Mayavadis, or something like that. They may be completely, they don't want to listen. It's much easier than other countries.
Even today, most of the Mayavadis, they're like having Khichdi philosophy. Everything is mixing.
Yeah. So they will also listen, though they may not accept it.
And also the atheists also in India, the hardcore atheistic people are very, very few. Because of circumstances, they will become atheistic. But
yeah.
Even they also don't have a problem. They're more of agnostics than of atheists.
Yeah.
Anyone?
Maharaj, like we Prabhupada, he was Shristram Vrindavan. So do we need to practice Raganuga Bhakti, or we can just desire that we can serve Prabhupada and his disciples as our spiritual master and then go back to Goloka Vrindavan?
Serving means we should follow his instructions. So then there are instructions in Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's just that if you walk Krishna and Goloka, then you have to practice Raganuga. So that's one of his instructions also. But it should merely matter when and how to do it, how to incorporate that into one's practice. So as I said, generally, as one gets older and has more time, then one can start doing some of the practices, like more chanting, absorption and hearing, pastimes of Krishna, and smarana, etc.
Any other devotee? Your colleagues
or Prabhupada? Sumrati, you see that temples are built only to identify certain extent, identify the faithful people, because faithful people visit the temple. But their intentions and goals may be different from pure bhakti.
Yeah.
Aishwarya, maybe that.
Yeah, so
when we start preaching to them about pure bhakti, they may feel that ISKCON is not meant for them or for the faithful, and they get distracted to other branches of sadhana, go to some other temple. Maybe I'm not discouraging or keeping away people really from getting advancement.
Well, we also have to preach according to the level of the person. Just as in school, they don't teach trigonometry in class 1. There's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They teach very basic things in the beginning. So that's so similarly, a devotee who is skillful, then he will preach according to the person and according to their faith. If their faith is a certain level, he has to start at the level and start teaching them. If they're at a higher level, they can teach more. So it's at the discretion and intelligence of the preacher to cultivate people so that they can advance, not that we can drive them away.
The problem is that they understand or in a sense, they talk about the Krishna Katha, the various episodes of Krishna's life and everything. Very sweetly they talk, and they sometimes even talk better than devotees. But the real aspect or the philosophical point of it, and the real purpose of devotion, then they don't understand.
Well, that's why it has to be gradually introduced to them, so they gradually understand. And then when they do, then of course they will give up their misunderstandings. But it's a gradual process. And they all have their certain attachments to their beliefs, so it takes some time before they give up those beliefs.
Last two questions, one from Prabhuji and any from Mataji. Anyone has any question? Any Vaishnavis, Matajis? No question. Last question.
Maharaj, why Krishna allows the Jiva to enjoy when it is actually entangling the Jiva and taking him away from himself?
Well, the Jiva by nature, the Lord gives all the Jivas some free will. Not complete free will, but some free will to choose for themselves. The definition of the jiva is he's a particle of consciousness with a sense of his own identity, I. He has a sense of I. And therefore he can perceive, and it says, I perceive, I enjoy, or I suffer. So it's the very nature of the jiva to do this. So then he has a choice of what he wants to see, what he wants to enjoy, etc. like this. So it's intrinsic to the jiva himself. Now, unfortunately, because he is dependent on the Lord and also very small, possible he makes wrong choices. So the Lord doesn't like those wrong choices, and therefore he tries to correct him, just as the parents try to correct the child. Another child may do something wrong, and then the parent tries to correct them. So the jivas in the material world are those that refuse the Lord. They don't want to recognize the Lord at all. So it's an unfortunate category. Those that accept the Lord, they're spiritual religious, etc. But the Lord is merciful to the jivas who are ignorant and choose not to serve him. But you can't force them to say, you have to serve me, you have to recognize me. Because even if he shows himself, they say, no, you're a material. That's a material form. That's Shishupala will say. He's a material entity. Or Rama, he's Ravana, he's Rama. He's always just a great king. He's not God. So therefore, gradually, they have to be re-educated. So it's not a sudden thing, gradual. So then we have different processes like Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, then we have Bhakti Yoga, and then we have scriptures, and we have association of devotees, and the Lord appears as avatar. So various means by which gradually the jiva can change his mind.
So this is a book which is released just now. Sri Radha.